This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Beijing's oldest neighborhoods are more than 500 years old. Think how many people have lived in these neighborhoods over that stretch of time. One of them is American Michael Meyer. He's lived in an old neighborhood in Beijing for a couple of years. He's seen great change come to neighborhoods like his. The old one-story buildings and small lanes are being raised in China's quest for modernization, a quest that has seen new urgency in the last several years as Beijing was being readied for the Summer Olympics. Michael Meyer has written a book about life in his centuries-old Beijing neighborhood. The title, The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. The tiny house that he rents for $100 a month is made up of two rooms. Neighbors live nearly on top of one another. The neighborhood is about the size of Vatican City, but its population, 57,000, is many times that of Vatican City. Meyer says it is a very public life. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Michael Meyer. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Michael Meyer, our guest, first went to China in 1995 with the Peace Corps. He was posted to a town in Sichuan Province and trained English teachers. After finishing his commitment with the Peace Corps in 1997, he moved to Beijing to teach English. There he met his wife. He fell in love, too, with Beijing. The Last Days of Old Beijing is published by Walker. You'll find Michael Meyer online at www.lastdaysofoldbeijing.com. And there you'll find links to a couple of YouTube videos featuring the author and his Beijing neighborhood. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Michael Meyer, good to talk with you. How are you?
Wonderful. Thanks for having me on, Celeste.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, you open the book by introducing us to a wonderful neighbor. You introduce readers to a wonderful neighbor, the widow. Would you do the same for us here this afternoon?
Well, the widow is an 80-year-old woman who lived most of the last 40 years in this house that I rented. And when I first moved in 2005, she fixed her eyes on mine and she said, "We have one rule here." And I said, "What is it?" And she said, "Public is public, private is private." I said, "Okay, that makes sense. We're all living on top of one another." And then she proceeded to break that rule every single day that I've been in the house by just walking into my door every morning at 7 a.m. and bringing me breakfast.
Yeah. Well, you write that if you weren't up by 7, you were likely to get a mild reprimand.
Exactly. Yeah. She thought I was lazy if I slept past 5:30, yeah, which is when most old-time Beijingers wake up, because that's when they say you can get the freshest meat and vegetables in the farmer's market.
Yeah, so she had already been to the market, and she had already made her dumplings by that hour.
She often said the best thing about the neighborhood was that she could put a pot of water on to boil, and then when she walked out to the market, got her vegetables, got her fresh pork for dumplings, by the time she got back to the house, the water would be boiling, and she could start cooking.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the routine of life in old Beijing, in this particular neighborhood, anyway?
It actually reminds me, I grew up in what was then rural Minnesota, and it really reminds me of the same kind of routines I had there. I mean, listeners can imagine camping. It's living in the hutong, these lanes, is kind of like urban camping. I mean, you wake up in the morning with the sun. It's usually not an alarm clock. We don't have roosters. We have cats that prowl on the rooftops that mew for their morning milk. But you wake up with the sun, and you go and gather food, and you build a fire, just like when you're camping. And then, you know, I don't have a bathroom inside the house.
Yeah.
And so I have to go to a public latrine, which is 10 minutes walk from my house, and I have that walk time down flat. And then, you know, we don't have a shower or a bathroom in the house either, and so we use the public bathhouse. And then school starts at 8 o'clock in the morning sharp, and so I'm there, you know, and the kids stand at attention at the flag, and they cock their right fist next to their ear, and they sing along with the national anthem, and that's the start of my day.
Teacher Plum Blossom.
Teacher Plum Blossom, that's me. My name, Meyer, in Chinese sounds like a son sold in the marketplace. Meyer. And so when I went to China with the Peace Corps, my first teacher in 1995 said, ooh, that name just won't do in China, son sold in the marketplace. So we're going to give you a new name, and they named me Heroic Eastern Plum Blossom. I prefer sold son, but everybody in the neighborhood calls me Plum Blossom, and my students all call me Teacher Plum Blossom.
Yeah, that's quite a moniker to live up to, Heroic Eastern Plum Blossom.
I know, I'm very bad at it, I must admit.
What was the toughest getting used to? What was it difficult to become accustomed to in this very public life?
Well, because I had been in Peace Corps in the middle of nowhere in rural Sichuan province, I was used to, you know, acclimating, as it were, to a Chinese neighborhood. I went to the Peace Corps when it had just started in China. I was in the second group of volunteers. We weren't even Peace Corps. We were called the U.S.-China Friendship Volunteers because Chairman Mao had successfully slandered the good Peace Corps name for decades as a CIA front. So I was in the middle of nowhere in 1995. I was the only Westerner there. They didn't know what to do with me. And so for 2 years, I was the starting center on the university basketball team. I traveled around the province and played basketball. Toughest job I'll ever love. So when I came to Beijing, and I lived in Beijing for many years, and I missed this sense of a community that I found in Peace Corps or that I grew up with in Minnesota. And so when I moved into this neighborhood, it took about 3 months, actually, for everyone to kind of get on board and understand what I was doing. I was volunteering at the school, which was very, very strange for Beijing. The school didn't know how to approach me. There are no volunteers, or there were no volunteers at that time in Beijing. I took a lot of police, you know, convincing the police. It took a lot of convincing the school. And really, once the widow said, he's a good neighbor, he's a good person, he's a good teacher, that's when things really started rolling for me.
Yeah. Now, before you moved to this neighborhood, where did you live in Beijing?
I live like most people. I live in a high-rise apartment building. My neighbors never spoke to me. I didn't know who picked up my trash. I didn't know who made my dumplings. It was a very anonymous life, and I could have been living in America, for that matter. It didn't have a lot of flavor or character.
So how did you find this house in Dajialan? And am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, very good. Dajialan. Dajialan is a neighborhood that's just south of Tiananmen Square, if listeners can picture the Forbidden City at the heart of old Beijing. Tiananmen Square is this massive 50-acre space just south of that. And then just on the rim of that is Dajialan. And as you said in your wonderful introduction, it's only a half square mile. It's the size of Vatican City. But there's 57,000 people living there. It's one of the densest urban environments in the world. It's mostly single-story housing, so people are really on top of one another. And I thought that as Beijing was slowly being eradicated, old Beijing, I should say, I wanted to experience something that was going to vanish. And so I did what modern Beijingers do, is I went online to their version of Craigslist, and I started looking for a place to rent.
Hmm. Does the neighborhood ever sleep?
The neighborhood never sleeps. When I first moved in, the police were very, very concerned. They really didn't want me to live there. They said, it's not safe. And I argued that actually it's incredibly safe because there's eyes on the street at all times. My bike had been stolen about 5 times in other places. I lived in Beijing. Since I've lived in the neighborhood, nothing has been stolen because it's just a 24-hour cycle there. Migrants from outside Beijing come into this neighborhood because they can make a living. As someone said to me, I could sell a bowl of water on the street every day and have a sustainable life here because there's always passerby. Tourists come. There's an amazing array of commerce. An urban planner once walked through the neighborhood and said to me, you know, aside from open heart surgery, everything you need is within a 15-minute walk of your door. Mm. And I've definitely found that to be true.
Yeah. One of the stories you tell about your students in the neighborhood involves you asking them where Beijing Zoo is located.
I was so surprised. I mean, Beijing's a very beautiful city. There's a lot of parks. There's a central lake area that's only a few miles. It's 2 miles from my house. And I was always surprised when we'd look out the window of the classroom that I taught in, which the school is the tallest building in the neighborhood. It's 4 stories. And so we could see this beautiful vista out the window. And I would often point outside and say, hey, kids, what's that building? And I'd be pointing at Chairman Mao's mausoleum on Tiananmen Square. And the kids would say, we have no idea. And I'd say, what's that building? And I was pointing at the Great Hall of the People, which is China's parliament. And they'd say, we have no idea. And I'd say, where's the zoo? And they'd say, we've never been. I thought, you guys have never left the neighborhood. And it was one day I was pointing out the window at another building, and the kids in the distance saw the golden arches, and they all yelled, McDonald's! I mean, that was an icon they all knew. And by the end of that school year, we could see Walmart as well.
Yeah. And the kids, though, we should mention here, they might not be so sharp on geography outside of the neighborhood, but they're very good at geography within the neighborhood, and they're also very good at all the other subjects that they are taught.
When I moved into the neighborhood, I realized from Peace Corps experience that I didn't want to just be there. I didn't want to just be the foreigner. And so I volunteered at the school, and I taught the same group of kids through grade 4, through grade 5, into grade 6. And one of the first projects we did in class was to map the neighborhood. The kids had never drawn a map before. And again, like you pointed out, they didn't know much about Beijing. You know, Beijing's the size of Connecticut. But they knew this half square mile intimately, and they could tell me exactly, you know, where's the place to get the best yo-yos? Where's the place to get the best dumplings? Where's the police station? Where's the doctor's office? And on and on and on.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Michael Meyer. He's a teacher. He's also a writer. His first book has now been published. It is called The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So, what's the future for your neighborhood?
Ooh, well, my future is going back in August and watching the Olympics from the neighborhood. The tickets are too expensive for people who live there, so they'll bring their TVs out onto the street and we'll sit in the lane and watch the games there. It's really a shrinking island. Old Beijing is 25 square miles. It's about half the size of Manhattan. And these neighborhoods are being eradicated slowly but surely. And our neighborhood is no exception. The only thing that's kept it from being demolished already is that there's 57,000 people there. And that's a lot of resettlement payments to give to people. Mm. And so it's one of the last, it's actually the oldest neighborhood in Beijing. It's one of the last ones standing. But at the end of April of this year, the posters went up. In Beijing, there's no transparency. You're really not. You can't go to a planning office. You can't go to city council meetings and listen to what's going to happen to your neighborhood. Instead, you wake up and there's a big poster or a character painted on your house that means raise. And those characters and posters went up at the end of April. So. Right now, they say it's going to still be standing for the Olympics, which I hope is the case, obviously. But then demolition will start happening in September.
Hmm. You'd think that maybe since the Olympics will be over that there might be a chance?
I certainly hope so, and that's one of the aims, you know, of why I wrote the book. I've been surprised in the last 2 years, especially. It's almost like depleted salmon stocks in Beijing, you know, that they've overfished, as it were, and that so much has been destroyed There were 7,000 of these lanes in 1949. And these lanes really are to Beijing what the canals are to Venice. I mean, they're that archetypal. You know, it's the character of the city. So these 7,000 lanes have been whittled down to about 1,500 now. So there's, in terms of acreage, there's less than 12% of the old city that's still standing. And because it's reached this tipping point now, there is a preservation movement afoot. And so hopefully, you know, I'm always surprised at how many tourists are starting to come to the neighborhood. Visitors often rate their experience in the neighborhood higher than visiting the Great Wall or the Forbidden City or these sort of museums. So I'm hoping there'll be some sort of movement to save it. Now, having said that, it's very difficult in Beijing because land prices have just skyrocketed since the games have been awarded. And because there's a zoning rule about building heights in the old city that things can't be over a certain height, scarcity has really increased, and the value of this land is just astronomical now.
Yeah. There's a story in the book about an area that was going to be raised, and it was the New Year celebration, and you went and visited this fellow by the name of Old Zhang.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked with his son and daughter-in-law, and his son told you, you know, development is a good thing.
Yeah.
So there's, and people maybe they would like to have their own bathroom.
Exactly.
So the question is, you know, what should be saved and how should it be saved?
That's a very good point. I was surprised in the book, you know, when I was doing the research, that most people weren't upset about leaving their homes because of the home's heritage value. They were upset about their relocation settlement. They were upset about the money they were receiving. And they were also upset because they were losing this community, you know, knowing who taught their child, knowing their doctor on the lane and whatnot. And so I think the real challenge for Beijing right now, and what the book title refers to, is not the preservation so much of this old architecture, but the preservation of these densely knit communities. And it's very difficult in Beijing because Beijing is unlike European cities or even American cities. Its architecture was built with wood and with mud bricks. So it's permeable architecture. It's not made from stone. I think most listeners, you know, if you can imagine visiting Paris or Rome, for example, these sites, this architecture that you visit is permanent. It's made from stone, and they're very public spaces. They're cathedrals. There are sports stadiums or coliseums that have lasted through the ages, and there's a sort of romantic decay that's lovely to visit. But in Beijing, these homes, this inhabited heritage, is built from materials that rot, and that's difficult right now in Beijing because China, you know, up until 1956, you could own your own home. In 1956, a socialist transformation of housing occurred. And the Beijing government, for example, said that housing was no longer a commodity. It was going to be a basic right. And so the state seized all these private homes and subsidized rents very, very low. So your monthly rent would be about the cost of a pack of cigarettes. I mean, that low. And so people stopped being stakeholders in their homes. They figured, oh, the city owns it now. We don't have to put our own money into its upkeep. And these homes have just, you know, slowly rotted over the past 50 years to the point now where they're really, a lot of them are, most of them actually are irreparable. You'd have to tear them down and build them anew. And the government now is transformed away from that. It's following market economics now, and it feels like it shouldn't be a landlord anymore for the city, and it should tear these houses down and just build new buildings.
Hmm. Let's take a call now from a listener. Our guest this afternoon, Michael Meyer, author of The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. Our first caller this afternoon is on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
It's really sad when you think of it because, you know, in the States here, with the energy and all that kind of stuff, the sprawling, you know, the concept now is that we got to bring things more back into town, you know, and that people can have, you know, closer access to it. And here in this particular area, they have it all. I mean, they have within walking distance, right? Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, my daughter moved to North Carolina, and I think at the university there, There's a community that you can actually, everything's within the community. In other words, you don't have to go out, you know, that kind of thing. The other one is that I had a former American student who married a Chinese woman and lived in Chicago, moved to Minneapolis. She had sort of difficulty in the, you know, with the cold weather and all that. She got to the point that she liked it, and they went back to China. And he just absolutely, I mean, he'd been there before, but he took a vacation there. He actually loved it. He wanted to move there. He was talking about, what, the $3 haircuts, is that right?
Yes.
And you could have a massage every day for, what, a few dollars?
Exactly.
And the main thing is you talked about the food. I mean, you go to the market every day. It's all fresh. Extensive array of vegetables. You know, I mean, you know, they have winter vegetables, fall, and I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. But anyway, I just wanted to. You're doing a wonderful show and very interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Do you want to follow up? You want to make
a
comment?
Yeah, I was going to say that I've, you know, when I go to these suburbs outside of Beijing, Beijing is surrounded by ring roads, these beltways that loop the old city. And when I first moved to Beijing, the second ring road was there. They had finished the third ring road right when I moved there in 1997. Now they're up to the sixth ring road. So if listeners can just imagine, Beijing is on this flat plain with some mountains off to the west, but it's, people describe the growth of the city as a pancake. You know, imagine putting a dollop of batter on a griddle and watching it spread concentrically outward. And that's what's happening in Beijing. And when I'd go to these suburbs, I was, you know, there isn't that density anymore. There aren't local markets. There isn't a place where you can go get your hair cut. People go to Walmart or they go to Carrefour, these big box stores. And I was with a Chinese architect, and I said, you know, America made these mistakes in the 1950s, I think. And he looked at me. He was really, really upset. And he said, look, we have every right to make the same mistakes America did. I thought, okay, so, you know, maybe it's going to take a few generations, I think, and China will start moving back in toward the city the way American cities are being planned now.
Let's take another call, a listener in Effingham on line 4. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very interesting show. I just had a couple of comments for the guest, and maybe he wants to add to it. I'm just wondering, with the growth in China and the story you're telling us, if you, I suppose, extrapolate that out, you know, where do you see China, where do you see Beijing 25, 50 years from now? In other words, are they going to reach a tipping point where it's just not going to be, you know, sustainable? I'm guessing there's no going back, and it's a wonderfully sad story, I guess you're saying, as, you know, as far as the old city goes, and it's being lost. And then I was just wondering, from your own point of view, you know, do you see, I think Celeste said you're married there. Do you see yourself ever coming back to the States? And do you miss the States? And, you know, how did you find yourself ending up in China? And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
Okay, great. I think what's happening in Beijing is what's happened to all major, you know, all world capitals, actually. Beijing is unique because it wasn't destroyed during World War II, like most European cities were, or Japanese cities. So a lot of this, you know, change in Beijing is just happening a century later, 50 years to 100 years later, than it happened, say, in American cities or European cities. Is it sustainable? I'm constantly amazed, and I've been amazed now for 15 years, that China keeps growing. I mean, how can you sustain 10% growth in GDP every year? And China's still going through that right now. It's this crazy boom time, like the Jazz Age was in the States. It's starting to break a little bit in terms of inflation. And I think that's one thing China watchers or people in the States should be aware of, is that prices have really shot up in the last year. Gas is up to $3.60 a gallon. That's upsetting a lot of people. Stores and shops are putting signs up saying, we apologize, the price of milk has doubled, the price of pork is going up, so we have to raise our prices 15%. I mean, even Starbucks and Subway and these American chains are putting signs up saying that. So that's certainly on everybody's mind there. As far as your question about what I miss about the States, I can't even begin. We could spend 3 hours talking about what I miss about the States. There's this impression I get when I do these interviews and I'm on tour for the book. People say, oh, well, Chinese people want to live like Americans do. And always hasten to correct them, and I say, no, they want to live like Chinese people with modern amenities. But even though there's these suburbs and there's a modernization of the cities, it looks nothing like America. There's no deficit financing for city planning. There's no bonds, for example. There's no referendums where citizens go to vote and decide how they want their communities to look. There's no public participation in the planning process whatsoever. There's no property taxes. Schools are funded, for example, from the city government. So you can't move to a community based on the quality of its schools. It doesn't work that way. There aren't open-stack public libraries. There isn't charity. There isn't, churches or temples that people go to on the weekends. And so it looks like America only in terms of wide streets, maybe, we'll say, and cars, you know, commuting in. And there's a strip mall with a Starbucks and a Domino's Pizza. But it isn't like an American community where people have a very large voice in how their community is shaped and looks.
Hmm. Thinking back now to the widow, she has moved to a suburb.
Yes.
And in the book, there's among the photos, there's a photo of apartment buildings in a Beijing suburb. I would think, I am sure she is a very, what's the right word? I'm sure she'll be fine and she will adapt. But at the same time, I would think it would be culture shock for her. And this apartment building or apartment buildings along this very wide, wide street, and the streets in the old neighborhood are very, they're just a fraction of that.
They're 5 yards across,
yeah.
Instead of 40 yards across.
Instead
right?
of, you know, like, I don't know how many lanes that is. But I'm wondering also if it wouldn't be, if you're relocated, if it wouldn't be culture shock, if you wouldn't find yourself feeling very lonesome or lonely.
Yeah, and I'm glad when you asked that question, you talked about adaptation. And I've done a lot of journalism in China. And when you're a journalist in China, I think the fear, if you speak Chinese and you've lived there for a while, the fear in the back of your head always is, am I getting this right? I mean, I'm reporting on this person's life right now, but will it be this way in a year or two? And you use the word adaptation, and that's a great point because people do adapt in China. They're constantly adapting. And the people in the book is character-driven, as you know, and I followed them over a couple of years because what seems like a tragedy at first, they often land on their feet because the economy is so robust and because choices and chances are opening before them. They're okay. You know, if you come back 2 years later, they're still making a living or they have a new life. With the widow moving out to the suburbs, the thing that broke her heart is that, you know, a lot of these elderly people can imagine, don't walk very well. They're used to close-knit spaces where they can kind of hobble out and get their daily necessities. But when you move to these blown-out new suburbs, when you need a car, it's very difficult to do that. And I think the most poignant thing she said to me was, I don't want to live in a high-rise apartment. I said, why? And she said, oh, the elevators. And I said, give me a break. You just get in, the door closes, you press a button. She swatted my arm. She said, you idiot, I know how to use an elevator. And I said, well, what's the problem? She said, well, if I live upstairs and I go out for my walk and I come back, what if the elevator's broken? And I said, well, what? And she said, I'll have to sleep outside. She can't walk up all the stairs to her house, and that was a real fear for her.
Yeah. Also, you know what? I suspect that the elevator would be about the size of her old house. And
that's true. She raised two kids in 65 square feet in a single room. That's right. That's a good point. I think the elevator is about the same size as her house.
Yeah. So, you know, that space and being accustomed to living in that kind of space, while I might find it quite tight. For her, it might feel like, you know,
like a nest.
Yes.
People often describe their homes in the old neighborhoods like that. It's like a nest, that it's a place you come back to re-energize and to sleep, but it's not a place that you stay inside. You know, she has a television and she listens to the Beijing, she watches while she listens to the Beijing opera station, which is always on. And so our courtyard always has these gongs and crashing cymbals and everything else because she loves the opera. But it's not a place that she would sit inside all day and entertain guests. I mean, her life was out on the lane, you know, gossiping with the other aunties. And I was really surprised, like, when Walmart moved down just to the side of our neighborhood, I thought, oh, no, Walmart, you know, people are going to hate this. But instead, you'd walk into Walmart, like, on a hot, sultry July day, and there'd just be, in the aisles, there would be grandmothers and aunties just standing there. You know, it was like a bee-in. They weren't shopping. Mm-hmm. They were just enjoying the air conditioning, but they were doing their exact same routine they would do on the lane. They were just doing it in the aisles of Walmart now, you know, this public life.
Yeah. Well, I remember living without air conditioning for a long, long time, and and it was like, let's go to the movies or let's go to the mall. And, you know,
it's funny, you know, like, I the book's not a polemic against development because, like you said, it's once you experience these amenities, you realize how wonderful they are. I mean, technology is fantastic. And even in the book, you know, I talk about how even though we have a public bathroom and I don't have heat in the house, I have broadband internet. And, you know, the Chinese telecom company just strung the broadband line over our tiled rooftop and dropped it right down into my house. So even though we don't have indoor plumbing, I can sit and listen to baseball games in the morning from America.
You know, thanks to the Olympics and the demand for English teachers, you were almost relocated. This was an opportunity, though, to meet a fellow who's in the book, Officer Lee, and another wonderful character, another wonderful person. And he came to you one day after he said, yeah, you should stay in the neighborhood. It's okay. Mm-hmm. Officer Lee came to you one day with a problem, and it involved a greeting card. And, you know, when you said earlier, am I getting this right? You know, one of the things you say at the close of this chapter is living abroad makes the familiar new again. Maybe you would tell us a little bit about Officer Lee and the, and here you can correct me if I mispronounce this, Heka.
The hook, huh?
Oh, okay.
Very, very good. Your Chinese is improving as we talk. You know, the police really didn't want me in the neighborhood. I was the only foreigner that was going to live there, and they thought it was going to be a world of headaches for them if something happened, which I think they're right to think that. It took many months for them to come around and say, okay, we'll register you here. It's okay for you to live here. And the reason that came about was really related to the Olympics and this drive to learn English. One day I got a frantic phone call from the police station. They said, you have to come in. You have to come in right now. And I thought, oh, this is it. They're going to evict me. And instead I went in, and they sat me down in a chair, and they had stern faces, and they didn't offer cigarettes or coffee or tea. And they said, we need to talk about this. And I said, what are you talking about? And they said, hookah. And I said, what's hookah? And they said, hookah. And I thought, who's hookah? And I thought somebody had ratted me out for doing something wrong. And they handed me a piece of paper. And in Chinese characters, I stared at it, and I started translating in my head, and I realized the words on the page said, the legend of the Christmas stockings. And I looked at Officer Lee, and I said, what the hell is this? And he said, well, we're having a Christmas party, and we want to have a presentation, and hookah means greeting card, and we'd like to put a story on our greeting card. So if you could translate this for us in English and explain to the other officers why Westerners hang stockings by the mantle, you know, for Santa Claus to fill. And so I sat there with them for an hour and translated this. And the phrase they kept coming back to was once upon a time, which is a phrase that, you know, Americans, we hear that all the time. It's just a trope. But hearing it in Chinese was really magical, and it was, you know, I was rehearing it for the first time, really. And Officer Lee looked at me, and he said, this is very familiar to you. And I said, yeah, it is. And he said, that's how I look at this neighborhood. I walk through it every day, but I don't see the history. I don't see the value of it the way you do. And Officer Lee and I became really good friends because he had to learn English for the Olympics, and what he wanted to learn more than anything was all the vulgarities in English. So he would know when a foreigner was cursing him. And so he would take me out for dumplings and beer, and we would sit there at the table, and as the entire restaurant would stare at us, I would just curse him out. You know, I'd call him every name in the book and compare him to his mother, and he would just keep ordering beers and writing notes, and he was happy as a clam.
Yeah. Well, speaking of once upon a time, the neighborhood, Dajilan, mm-hmm. goes back to the 15th century.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you do so wonderfully in the book is that you weave the history of these neighborhoods and the history of the city into the story. Tell us a little bit about this place and how was it settled, by whom, why was it called Dajilan, which means big fence?
The neighborhood, you know, Beijing, when Marco Polo came to Beijing in the 13th century, he marveled at this amazing chessboard of streets, you know, this rigid north-south, east-west grid of lanes. My neighborhood doesn't have that. Succeeding dynasties and emperors of these dynasties banned tea houses, brothels, opium dens, restaurants, theaters, acrobat halls, everything. They banned those things from all the fun things in
Beijing.
All
the good stuff.
all the good stuff. They banned from the imperial city, the area around the Forbidden City. And they banned them, and they said, you guys can move just south of the Forbidden City. Just move outside this wall. And so Dajilan, this neighborhood, really became the Chinatown of Beijing. I mean, all the things that we associate with Han Chinese or Beijing culture started here. This is where Peking duck flourished. This is where acrobats flourished. This is where Beijing opera took hold. And so this area, it wasn't under imperial planning codes. And so the streets here were hastily settled. They don't run in a north-south, east-west grid. They're diagonal. They double back on themselves. The architecture wasn't all one story. You could have two-story theaters with wooden verandas and whatnot. It was just this incredibly eclectic district. And for the last 600 years, it's existed as that. And in a large way, it still is. I'm amazed at how many Chinese tourists, for example, come through the neighborhood, because for them, this really is Greenwich Village of China. You know, this is the loop of China. This is the part of Beijing they want to visit the most, because this is where all the history is.
Very interesting. And there is an interest in history. There's an interest in the city for antiques.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who are working on the issue of preservation. And one of these folks that you write about in the book is a professor, Feng Zhikai.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Okay. So
You're fluent by the end of our talk. I'm impressed.
Yeah. So what are his thoughts about what to preserve, how to balance mm-hmm. things? And if Beijing is facing this problem, problem is the wrong word to use,
mm-hmm.
this situation, what's going on elsewhere in the country, in smaller communities or in middle-sized cities? In the countryside.
Yeah, I do. National Geographic has a program called the Center for Sustainable Destinations, and I'm their China representative. And what that means is I go to Chinese cities and I try to convince city elders to preserve districts in their old towns, to preserve this sense of place. There's no way to translate sense of place into Chinese because it just doesn't exist. Chinese cities aren't like European cities. They weren't, or American cities for that matter, they weren't built around markets and sprawled amorphously. I mean, they were planned as administrative centers. They served a function. China's a rural country, and it didn't have this sort of awareness that cities are important or that heritage could actually be in cities. And so what I do is I go around to these UNESCO-certified sites. And Chinese cities right now go after world heritage status the way actors go after Oscars. I mean, it brings you tourist dollars. It brings you recognition. And people really, really want it. And there has been, to my surprise, since I first went to China in 1995 with the Peace Corps, in the last decade, there's been a real growing awareness that heritage is a viable economic stimulus, I could say. Everything in China right now is based on the economy. Nothing matters unless it makes money. And people are starting to realize now that heritage actually can attract tourist dollars, and so it's important to preserve different parts of your city. Now, along those lines, people often ask me, like, well, can you rail against the state in China? And the answer is yes. There are muckraking journalists, there are preservationists, there are activists. All preservation starts as a dissident movement. You know, I mean, people are always going up against the city first. The city rarely says, we're going to preserve this. In the book, I even talk about in Chicago, Grant Park was the result of a citizen movement spearheaded by A. Montgomery Ward to preserve that space. So in China, there are people that are doing this. And in the book, I follow a couple of them. The rule in China right now is it's an unwritten rule, but it's true. And it's that as long as you don't organize, you're okay. As long as you don't file lawsuits, as long as you don't, you know, get 10,000 people to show up at a march, you can criticize the government and press for change. And so the people in the book that I profile are actually people like you said. One's a professor, one's a journalist, and they're working within the system to sit in city planning meetings and to try to convince people to preserve parts of their city.
Hmm. That is, you know, that is so foreign to us. I think.
Yeah.
We go for the big grassroots movement and get people out there.
Exactly. And in China, it's just
it doesn't work.
That it's illegal because in the final analysis, all land is owned by the state still. So you can buy a house, let's say, or you can build an office building, but you're only getting a 70-year lease on the land beneath it. And because all land is still owned by the state, anything you advocate, you know, any sort of city movement or preservation project is essentially going up against the state and saying, we want this land to be used differently, and that's illegal. Yeah. So people are prohibited from doing that.
Yeah. Dajalan has seen many changes over the course of the centuries.
600 years, yeah.
Yeah. And the place that you call home was once a mansion.
Mm-hmm.
How old is your building, and when did it become home to so many people?
Oh, it's so difficult in Beijing to try to do a very factual, you know, sort of analysis of when the building existed and who used to live there. And in the book, I talk about how difficult it was to go to the city archives and try to find, you know, some sort of ledger or tax records or a title abstract of who used to own it. And my neighborhood was burned down in 1901 during the Boxer Rebellion. The Boxers were, Westerners call it xenophobic, Chinese call it patriotic. They were a movement that was trying to get rid of Western influences in the capital and throughout China. And so they torched the neighborhood in 1900, 1901. A lot of the houses in the neighborhood were built after that. And I actually found at the archives that my house, the earliest record I could find was from the 1930s. A migrant merchant built it and lived there. And he sold traditional herbs and medicines out of a stall in the front of the house. And then he divided it into four separate courtyards. I mean, it's a massive, beautiful old house. There's pictures of it in the book, and there's a map. If people go to Beijing, they can still visit it while it's there. But he divided it into four courtyards, and he had his entire family there. He had three children. They had servants. His daughters worked for him. His son went to school. His daughters did not. And it's funny, when I walked through the neighborhood, and I would talk to old-timers there, and I would say, do you remember this guy? Do you remember this person? And people would look at me with blank faces and say, no, I have no idea. And I asked the widow, I said, well, you must have known him because you moved in to this house in the 1940s. And she said, oh, no. You know, by then, they had fled to Taiwan for the Civil War. They had fled the Japanese occupation of the neighborhood, and then the Civil War happened. So, you know, this neighborhood has gone through so many historical eras that a lot of the history and the records have vanished.
Mm. Well, when I sit down to watch the Olympics, Michael, I'll be thinking of you and your neighbors
thank you.
In China. And I will, part of me will be wishing that I was there with you.
Well, please come while you can. Yeah.
Yeah. One more won't always room for one more.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. One more person in a 57,000 neighborhood won't influence.
I won't be noticed. I want to thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon and with our listeners.
Thanks, Celeste. This was a wonderful interview. I really appreciate your preparation.
You're very
welcome.
Thanks
to the listeners, too.
It was my pleasure to prepare for this interview. Michael Meyer has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of The Last Days of Old Beijing, Life in the Vanishing Backstreets of a City Transformed. The publisher is Walker. And look for our guest also online at www.lastdaysofoldbeijing.com. There you'll find links to a couple of YouTube videos featuring the author and his neighborhood. And do look for the book, The Last Days of Old Beijing, Michael Meyer, M-E-Y-E-R.